Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Nancy Horan, whose new historical novel is Under the Wide and Starry Sky. We'll also hear from Natalie Basile, author of the debut novel, Queen Sugar. Nancy Horan is a longtime journalist who turned to fiction, and the result was the 2007 bestseller Loving Frank, about Mamah Borthwick Cheney, Frank Lloyd Wright's lover. Nancy's new book is the gorgeous Under the Wide and Starry Sky, about the life of Fanny Vandergrift Osborne Stevenson, who became the wife of Robert Louis Stevenson. It is a stunning historical romance about a lifelong love, and you will while away many happy hours reading it. Nancy Horan, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
I love this book, but then I love Loving Frank, too. And you discovered that first subject while touring a Frank Lloyd Wright house and realizing that the docents didn't speak much about Mamah Cheney. So how did you find Fanny Vandergrift?
Well, between books, I was looking for a good subject, and I did explore some women who interested me. But I hadn't met Fanny and Louis yet. Louis is the name that his family and friends called Robert Louis Stevenson. So I was visiting in the Monterey Bay area, and I learned that Robert Louis Stevenson had lived in Monterey for a while. And I thought, well, what was he doing there? You know, here's this young Scottish writer, author of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Treasure Island, and I never knew he had a connection to the United States. And even despite the fact that I had lived in California for a while, and there are all kinds of schools named after Robert Louis Stevenson, I did not know about that connection. And so when I learned about it, I discovered that he had come to Monterey from England, across the Atlantic and across the plains in an emigrant train, and he had come to persuade her to go through with a divorce from her husband, who was a philanderer. She had been separated from him for some time. Stevenson had met Fanny at a sort of a bohemian artist retreat in France. And so when I learned that there was this whole story there, I was really drawn in by the connection to America. And that's when I read a biography and saw the potential of the story.
Now, Fanny was unconventional and determined from the very beginning, wasn't she?
She was. She was an Indiana girl who had married at 17 to a young man who went off to the Civil War. She was from an earlier period than Mamah Cheney, who was the protagonist in Loving Frank. And she eventually followed him. He went out to mine for silver in California, and she followed him. And Fanny had a very adventurous spirit, and she had a lot of grit to be able to do the things she did. For example, to follow her husband to the silver mining field of Nevada, she had to take a train east from Indianapolis to New York, take a steamer to the Isthmus of Panama, get off, get on a train across the isthmus, take another steamer up the Pacific coast to San Francisco, where she disembarked with very little money, and then got into a stagecoach and went off to a little mining shack in Nevada. And she was so inventive and so clever. And she was like a Wild West figure, like a pioneer woman. She rolled her own cigarettes. She carried a pistol. She was a character. But she was also a refined woman in many ways, with aspirations for literature. She wanted to write stories. She did write short stories and eventually published some. And she was an artist. So she had a strong character to begin with before she met Stevenson. And probably that's what attracted him so much.
Well, one of the things that keeps coming home to the reader time and time again is how very brave she was. I mean, going off to Belgium to study art, taking her children, that kind of set the stage as well. And one of the other things is that this bravery is often in the face of great fragility. I mean, certainly her economic survival was often in question, you know?
You're very right about that, yeah. I think you hit on something. I think on the outside, she was very brave. And I think on the inside, she was fragile. She was easily wounded. And so she was fearless, too, though. I mean, I think she just screwed up her courage and off she went. And she was responsible. Stevenson had lung illness from the time he was a child. Often he was bedbound and cooped up in his house when he was a kid. And then as an adult, he suffered from lung illness that was possibly tuberculosis. That's how it was diagnosed at various points. It may have been some other lung condition. We're not really sure, but it incapacitated him from time to time. And Fanny, when she married Stevenson, to her credit, she married for love, because once her divorce came through, once she married him, by the time he arrived in America to see her in Monterey, he was nearly dead. He had become so ill on the journey to Monterey that he had to be nursed by various people to get him back to some semblance of health. And Fanny certainly was one of those people. And when she married him, he was nearly broke. He had no reputation as a literary figure and no prospects, and he was ill. So that was a woman who had deep love in her heart for him, as he loved her, and just a lot of grit to believe that she could make it all work. And they were so broke when they married that they took their honeymoon and went to Napa in California, and after staying at a hotel for a short period, they went up a mountain where the air was clean and it was sunny above the fog line, and they camped in an abandoned mining shack. And Fanny fashioned doors out of old boards with a hammer, and she made hinges by cutting up a leather boot. I mean, she was so inventive.
She's one of those fictional heroines you want to take to a desert island.
Exactly.
She'll make the best of it.
Yeah, exactly. She was fascinating to me.
Now, when you love history and you love historical fiction, you read a book like this and you're drawn to other books. You know, this is a book that made me want to go back and read Kidnapped and Treasure Island and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I also imagine it from your point of view. And this must have been just a delight for you to research.
Oh, it was, because, you know, part of the job was reading primary sources, of course. So reading her letter, they're unpublished. I went to UC Berkeley and looking for her voice. And her voice kind of changed over time and changed depending upon who she was writing to. And then reading Stevenson's letters and some of his materials at Yale University. But Yale published an 8-volume set of his letters. He was a prolific letter writer, as he was a prolific fiction and nonfiction writer. And those letters were just so marvelous because they are in a voice that's very contemporary and funny, witty, heartbreaking in some places when he's ill and struggling. Just fascinating. So that in itself, just reading the letters and Fanny's diaries were marvelous. And then reading Stevenson's works. And he was so prolific, you know, 13 novels. I can't count the short stories. He began as a travel essayist. So he has these marvelous essays, not only about travel, but when he met Fanny, he wrote an essay called On Falling in Love, and it's a beautiful essay. He wrote so many thoughtful things, and I just so enjoyed having the wonderful professional excuse of diving into his work.
And you went to Scotland as well, didn't you?
I did. I stayed in his boyhood home, which is a B&B now, and I stayed in his parents' bedroom. It was just so interesting to occupy that house. It's been kept almost as it was when he was living there. And you just had this feeling of being able to experience it the way he did. For example, you look out the front dining room and you see the light post that appears in A Child's Garden of Verses. So you can imagine this little kid just running up and down this winding set of stairs and playing in his room and that kind of thing. Love that. And then just followed their whole life together, Fanny and Lewis, was a quest, really. It was a quest for a climate. This is the 19th century when antibiotics didn't exist, so climate was regarded as the solution or the treatment for his lung ailment. And so I followed their footsteps to different places they lived, as many people do now. Today they follow Stevenson's footsteps around the South Seas in their boats, and they follow his footsteps in the Cevennes in France where he toured the mountains. And I was moved by different places. I went to Hyères, where he lived in the south of France, and he said, I was happy once in Hyères.
Wow.
He was happy more than that, I think. But he was especially happy in Hyères. And he and Fanny occupied a little house. It's like a miniature house overlooking the ocean. And it was quite beautiful, and I think they were together there alone and very happy. And also I visited an empty lot. The house that his father had given to Fanny during their marriage was destroyed during World War II. So now it's just an empty lot. I think there's just a little bit of a footprint of a foundation there now. And to imagine what it was like for him to be bedbound. He was tremendously unhappy in his years in Bournemouth, England. And to imagine him writing The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 3 days.
Right.
1,000 words.
Woo.
He was amazing.
These are two very unconventional and interesting women, and in writing about them, you've lived with them for long periods of time. What about their lives have you taken to heart for your own?
I'm inspired by their willingness to go against the grain. I've really tried not to pretend they are something they aren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I take them where I find them. And Fanny was in a traditional role and embraced the traditional role in many ways. And yet it was just her personality. And I think it was the personality and the characteristic of a lot of women, pioneer women especially, to just have physical strength, inventiveness, courage. And so I'm impressed by their courage. But I also really love them for their humanity and for their foibles and frailties and flaws. I mean, my goodness, both of the women had numerous flaws. And I'd rather portray them in that sense because those flaws really account for some of the twists in the story.
Mm-hmm.
They're important to know about. And they make it easier for us to really relate to them than to idealize them. So I'm inspired by, I guess, the fact that they're willing to listen to their own inner moral compass.
And who wants to write about a perfect person? Who wants to read about a perfect person, actually?
Right, exactly, not me.
We've been talking with Nancy Horan, whose new novel is Under the Wide and Starry Sky. It imagines the life of Fanny Stevenson. You can meet Nancy Wednesday, February 12th at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much, Nancy.
My pleasure.
Novelist Natalie Bazile has a master's degree in African American Studies from UCLA and a Master of Fine Arts from the Warren Wilson Program for Writers. Her first novel, Queen Sugar, is already garnering accolades. Natalie is a California girl, but her Louisiana family roots grow deep. Queen Sugar tells the story of a California girl named Charlie Bordelon, who inherits 800 acres of sugarcane land on the condition that she farm it. Her struggle to survive in this new life makes for wonderful reading and marks Natalie Bazile as a writer to watch. Natalie, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Would you tell us a bit about those Louisiana roots of yours?
Oh, sure. My dad is actually from a small town called Elton near Lake Charles, and he grew up there and stayed there until he was in high school. And then he spent his high school years in Port Arthur, Texas, before he came out to California. But all of his siblings, all of my cousins, are still in that area or in Baton Rouge. So even though I'm a native Californian, I feel like I can claim New Orleans and South Louisiana as my home. My dad gave me that great gift.
Mm-hmm. And when you thought about setting a novel here, you didn't take it lightly. You did some serious homework, didn't you?
You know, I did. My goal with this book was to make sure that it really rang true to the people who live there. And I had the great fortune of meeting some just wonderful people in South Louisiana, many of them involved in the sugarcane industry, who opened up their homes and their lives and, you know, their farms and really just made it their business to be generous and kind and welcoming to me. And so kind of the litmus test for this book, and I used to tell them this all the time, was when they read this book, I wanted it to ring true for them. I wanted them to be able to read it and for folks in South Louisiana to read it and feel that I really got it right. So I did everything I could between 2005, when I first started coming down to do research for the book, and, you know, my last revision to make sure that I really captured the spirit and the feel of South Louisiana.
Now, there are two reasons I love Queen Sugar. Now, first are the characters. Charlie Bordelon is this wonderful, uprooted city girl with a big heart, good instincts, and living with her grandmother, Miss Honey, is not always the easiest situation. And then transplanting her young daughter is another difficulty. And you've said that Miss Honey is based somewhat on your grandmother. So tell us about these women.
Well, Miss Honey is based loosely on my grandmother, Miss Rose, who, you know, was the matriarch of the family, ruled over everyone in this little town of Elton. She was the founding member of her church and, you know, was just a very simple woman, but had a big heart and a big spirit. And when she was alive, you know, she was just such a captivating presence. And I loved being around her when my dad and I would go to visit. So she was definitely the inspiration for the Miss Honey character. And I guess Charlie is me in the sense that, you know, she's a Western girl, doesn't, you know, have any childhood experience or a lot of childhood experience in the South, and really just goes down there with an open heart and big eyes and is trying to make her way. And I think, you know, as I was writing the book, a lot of the sense of wonder and amazement that I felt whenever I would go and do research and meet people, I wanted to give Charlie that same sense of delight and feeling comfortable, but also feeling kind of out of place at the same time.
And there's a lot of joy in this book. A lot of heartache, too, but a lot of joy.
Yeah.
Now, the other reason I love Queen Sugar is that at its very heart, it's a novel about work, about the hard labor of sugarcane farming. And you go into great detail about what that work really is.
Well, you know, again, I had just the great fortune of meeting some people, you know, who live this life, who are sugarcane farmers and who do have this connection to the land. And, you know, I think personally, I always love books that deal with work and, you know, show people engaged in just the day-to-day business of life. So it was really thrilling for me to, you know, have the opportunity to plant sugarcane. And I have to tell you, that is some of the hardest work I have ever done in my life. I had no idea what I was getting myself into when I asked these two brothers, Clint and Chad Judice, if I could work on their sugarcane farm. But I loved it. And, you know, again, it was a chance for me to really convey that sense of connection with the land and labor that I always think makes a book especially interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a great time doing it.
I bet you got in shape, too.
Oh my God.
It's really hard work.
It is so hard, Susan. I can't even tell you. I was covered in dirt. I had dirt in places I didn't even know dirt could go by the time I finished planting that sugarcane in the middle of August, out in the middle of this field. But I loved it. I loved it.
Yes, your descriptions of that are quite convincing, I have to tell you. Well, because the great thing about Charlie is that Charlie doesn't spare herself any difficulty. She's not looking for someone to do it for her. She's looking for someone to teach her how to do it.
Exactly. And, you know, that's a lesson that, you know, I have to give my dad credit for. He was always one to say, get out there and do the work yourself. And, of course, take any help that's offered. But he really did. That was kind of his life's motto or his ethic. It was hard work and engagement. So I just threw myself into this project and, you know, had a lot of amazing experiences as a result.
Now, you've also gone to great pains. I mean, any novel about South Louisiana is going to have some element of race in it. And this is a novel that fights against stereotypes on every level.
Well, you know, part of the reason why I love South Louisiana in particular is because the history is complicated but rich. The people are interesting. And there's this wonderful mix of cultures and histories and background that I have always found myself drawn to. I wish I could tell you how many times I have told people here in San Francisco or, you know, other places that I've gone, I've tried to describe what it is about Louisiana that is so compelling to me. And I think it is that mix of beauty and pain that keeps drawing me back. And I really wanted the novel to explore those questions of race and identity and history. That was one of the great joys for me, was to really get in there and try to look at those questions from a historical point of view, but also from a contemporary view, because I do feel that in many ways, Louisiana has changed so much, and people are open and willing and curious, and I just wanted to celebrate that and also really take a good, honest look.
And in the best Louisiana fashion, this is a novel that will make people hungry, and it will make people want to dance.
That is true.
I know. Road trip to Lejeune's Bakery, you know.
That is true. You know, it's so funny because when I used to come down to Louisiana with my dad, in the early days of research on this book, it wasn't even actually set in sugarcane country at the time that my dad and I first started coming back. And he would always bring this insulated food bag with him, because being a native Louisianan, he would have to stop off at each little town that we would pass through to gather food. And by the time we left, he would really have 50 or 60 pounds of boudin and sausage and, you know, crawfish tails that he would carry back with him. So food has always been a huge part of my life growing up, even though I did not grow up in Louisiana. I always felt that connection. And yeah, food is a huge part of my life.
Well, good. That's an important test for anyone who comes here, you know. So what's next? Do you think you found your true subject in Louisiana, or do you think you're moving on with the next book?
Oh, no, I'm not finished. I'm not finished with Louisiana, and I don't think that Louisiana is finished with me. I have another idea for a Louisiana book. I'm just in the very beginning stages of writing it. And actually not even writing, just kind of taking notes and thinking and doing some research. So I'll be back. I would be happy if every book I wrote from now on had something to do with Louisiana, because I just feel the place has so much to offer and, you know, is so rich and interesting. I could spend my whole life writing about Louisiana.
All right. Well, that's good to hear. And you're one of those writers who's come and bought a house in the New Marigny. So you're fairly serious about this.
You know, I am. I just can't stay away. As a matter of fact, my little house there is rented for the time being since, you know, we have a daughter who is still in high school. So I cannot spend as much time as I want to there. But I'm coming back next summer. I'll be there for the whole month of July and can't wait.
Well,
can't wait to get there.
Everybody should watch out for you. They should watch out for this book, pick it up and read it, and then tell you their stories when you're here next summer.
I'll take it. I would love that.
We've been talking with Natalie Bazile, whose wonderful new novel is Queen Sugar. You can meet her Thursday, February 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much, Natalie.
Thank you, Susan. It's really been fun.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Arthur and Pauline Frommer signed Frommer's Travel Guides Tuesday, February 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Kim Marie Vaz discusses The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. That's at Author Night, Tuesday, February 11th at 6:30 at the Hubble Branch Library in Algiers Point. Today's guest, Nancy Horan, signs Under the Wide and Starry Sky, Wednesday, February 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Oblivion Atlas Happy Hour had to be rescheduled after our recent snow days. The event now takes place Wednesday, February 12th at 6 upstairs at Mimi's in the Marigny. Jeff Louvier and Vanessa Brown and Michael Allen Zell will all be on hand to sign books, and there will be readings of selected stories by Big Easy Award-winning actors Michael Martin and Richard Mayer, starting promptly at 6:30. David Harris Gershon discusses and signs his book, What Do You Buy the Children of the Terrorist Who Tried to Kill Your Wife? A Memoir. Wednesday, February 12th at 7:30 at the New Orleans Jewish Community Center. This month's Reading Between the Wines series features writing on love and romance and takes place Wednesday, February 12th at 8:30 at Pearl Wine Company in the American Can Building. Featured readers include romance novelist Farah Roshan, Viola Russell, Alice Kemp, and poet Gina Ferrara. The event is co-sponsored by the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans. The next book club discusses Where'd You Go, Bernadette? By Maria Semple, Wednesday, February 12th from 7 to 8:30 at the Nix branch of the New Orleans Public Library. The UNO Creative Writing Workshop and Department of Fine Arts hosts a reading by guest poet Laura Glenham, Wednesday, February 12th at 8 at the UNO Campus Art Gallery, followed by a book signing and reception. Sarah Baird signs Kentucky Sweets, Bourbon Ball, Spoon Bread, and Mahi Pie, Thursday, February 13th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Natalie Bazile, signs Queen Sugar, Thursday, February 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Writers Gina Ferrara, author of Amber Porch Light, and Jonathan Klein, author of The Wisdom of Ashes, read from their works and discuss the importance of poetry in a Valentine's Day presentation, Thursday, February 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Errol Laborde signs Mardi Gras, Chronicles of New Orleans Carnival, Thursday, February 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Joel Dinnerstein discusses and signs American Cool, his catalog accompanying an exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. That's Friday, February 14th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Randy Perry signs The Jury, Saturday, February 15th from 10 to noon at Garden District Bookshop. The Southeast Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America, that's SOLA, meets Saturday, February 15th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Guest speaker and licensed counselor Kelly Stone discusses how to free your creative mind. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood, Saturday, February 15th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Poet Peter Cooley, whose new collection is Night Bus to the Afterlife, and Sean Strube, author of Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival, read Saturday, February 15th at 2:30 at Faulkner House Books. The Maple Leaf Bar reading series features Lafayette poets Toby Despot and James Blanchard, along with New York poet Paul Pines, Sunday, February 16th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Dawn Ruth Wilson signs her new mystery, The Nightwalker's Song, Tuesday, February 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Louisiana Research Collection is presenting an exhibit of the designs of the 1892 Crew of Proteus Parade, A Dream of the Vegetable Kingdom. That's in the Special Collections Gallery, Room 201, of Jones Hall at Tulane University. These designs are the work of Carlotta Boncaz, the first woman and the first Creole to design floats for a crew. The Special Collections Gallery is open Monday through Friday, 10 to 5, Saturday, 9 to 1. Admission is free. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.